Session number 9278.
Mr. Cotman, reel 7.
We will be viewed more and more suspiciously, and our position in Spain would become increasingly difficult, as it indeed it proved to be. So, therefore, the general idea was to arrange for a tidy and orderly departure before the position was reached that we were in Spain without any protection of the authorities that we had been representing up until now.
So when was it that you actually left Spain?
I left Spain in June. It might have been June the 10th. And about the middle of June, anyway.
And did the whole ILP contingent leave with you?
Oh, no. They all left at different times. I left with John McNair, George Orwell, and his wife. And then others left at different times. Some went earlier, some went later. A couple that went earlier, I know, met with disaster. A chap called Norton from New York. He's still alive and kicking, they tell me. He left. And he was in difficulties in getting money to get home and everything like that. He didn't have much money. And he had a big hotel bill. So he said to me, I'd like you to help me get out of this hotel. What we'll do is I'll come down early in the morning and leave my cases over there by the lift, and you can come in and visit me. And then almost without noticing, pick up my bags and walk out to an agreed cafe along the road, and then I'll meet you there somewhere. And then you can see me off for home from the station, which wasn't very far away. So that's what we did. And this went off all right up until that moment. But as he got near the border, police boarded the train, international and American, of course. They hiked him out of it on suspicious grounds. And then, of course, he got confronted with a further charge of not having paid his hotel bill. And I actually went to visit him in prison before I left. Horrible prison it was in Barcelona. I remember as I went in the doors, there's a lot of noise going on. And it seemed to be, on the left, they were all women, and most of them seemed to be pregnant women, as far as I could take in this scene. And they were all rattling on the bars, you know. And I thought, my goodness, how can anyone ever endure life in this place, because they were all tightly packed. And eventually I shuffled over. One side seemed to be women, the other side seemed to be men, and we shuffled over, and there was an unhappy Harry Milton. And, well, get me out of this, he said. And John McNair was a fluent French speaker. And he said, yeah, well, we'll do everything we can. We'll go to the embassy and shift everything, and we'll put some money up to pay this hotel thing, and maybe you can go. He eventually did get out. That was some of them. I left with John McNair and George Orwell, and it was a fairly peaceful thing. The hotel people are supposed to phone the police whenever internationals are booking in, so that if the police are suspicious of them, they can check them out. But this chap, he said, why don't you stop here for the night? This was John, Eileen, and George Orwell and myself, because we said, oh, well, we better be going there, and we were going to find a place to sleep. So John says, "Oh, we can't do that because you have to phone the police, don't you?" And tell them we're in and all that. "Oh, I won't bother doing that," Mr. Chap said, "you know, if you want to stop here, you can." So we stayed there, and he didn't phone the police, and we got on the train next day, and we had quite a peaceful, uneventful voyage to Port Bow over the Pyrenees and then home. And my only claim to fame, I sometimes joke, is that I left Spain the same day as George Orwell, and because of that, everybody wants to know. They say, "You left Spain the same day as George Orwell. Well, do you mind if I come along and have an interview? Can you tell their paper this sort of thing?" And all that. And they're not interested in the fact that I belong to my trade union all my life, or that I've never been out of office in any Labour Party branch. They don't want to know those things. George Orwell, you left Spain the same day. That's the thing, you see.
Now, going back to the Aragon front,
yes.
You've already said about the relative lack of fighting.
Yes.
How much fighting was there whilst you were there?
Well, there was no, I believe there was some, but I never saw, and I didn't take part in any hand-to-hand, you know, point of the bayonet, sort of up against the wall, slug it out business. Although, in fairness, I understand that some of that did take place. Certainly there was chases along parapets in other parts of the front, where they seemed to have got a few of them into the trench, and then there wasn't much about, so they chased along until they met resistance from the other end. There was a bit of that. There was some mortar fire, shelling, which fell miles from us anyway, or hundreds of yards, perhaps, rather than miles. There were sudden machine gun attacks, and there were places where it was obvious to keep away from. There were some Moors who were apparently conscripted or fighting for Franco, that made sudden rushes over the top and came towards us, but were shot in the sort of no man's land place, and some of them laid there for a long, long time. So really, Kopp's description of it being a comic opera of war where occasionally someone got killed is a fair one, I think. We had all the comic opera of the ragtag and bobtail, not very tidy army, with all sorts of old equipment that's, you know, pretty useless. And occasionally somebody got killed, very often, by weaponry which was more harmful to you than the enemy.
Did you ever fire your rifle?
Oh, yes. But and all right, it didn't do me any harm, except it gave you a nasty jolt in the shoulder. And I suppose because I was inexperienced, I used to think, "Oh, I wonder about that. You know, that seems too much." And having known of them explode, and having known some casualties who were people that had damaged themselves, made you very cautious about it. But I don't suppose it was any really different from the kickback of an ordinary rifle, which is much more diminished now, I notice, than it was even during the Second World War. Lee Enfields were, it wasn't such a strong kick as these blowing Mausers.
How many rounds would you have fired, do you reckon, personally?
Well, not all that many, because there was an ammunition shortage. You were advised to preserve it, and so firing off any was a sort of luxury anyway. But I shouldn't think more than the whole time we were there. Now and again we had a we'd try and shoot things on post and things like that, which was, I would say, not more than about 30. I don't remember firing five, you know, five rounds rapid, which we used to have. I don't remember ever firing five rapid at the Aragon front.
Do you know if you hit anything personally?
No, I just don't think so. Certainly we aimed at and took careful aim sometimes, like a sniper thing. But I've always felt not. I've always thought that because there was never any evidence, you know, you didn't see anyone fall or any sign of anything. They were quite a way away. I noticed the last time I was there, from where we were to the sort of borders of Huesca, where we were just outside, it seemed a long way then, and the last time I saw it, it seemed nearer, and yet I would say that it was more than a half a mile. Probably wasn't a mile. Well, people don't look all that big, you know, you can't get a good target. You can up to a few hundred yards, I think. Or maybe if you've got these telescopic things, it might be a different...
I know that Orwell, in Homage to Catalonia, talks about refraining from shooting someone when he could.
Yes.
Was that a general feeling? Did you share that same feeling, or would you have shot
him? No, I think that thing, that comes about because there was an attack and they caught these Spaniards along the trench a bit unaware. It was early in the morning. And one of them was doing his trousers up. So the human thing with Orwell, he says, no one could possibly shoot anyone when they're doing their trousers up. I mean, that really is below the belt, sort of. Otherwise, no. If we could have shot somebody, we would have, you know, with any degree of certainty and sense. It was just the fact that most of the time you couldn't see them. If you did, you had to be careful that it was him that was shot and not yourself. You had to watch the ammunition thing because there was such a shortage of it. If you weren't careful, especially the Spanish ammunition, it jammed. So you could very well find yourself in more problems than the one you had trying to shoot and identify the bloke in the first place. But I never got close enough to be able to warrant really shooting at them, or I'm pretty sure I would have done out of sheer self-defense, you know. You say, well, if we don't shoot him, maybe in a little while's time he'll shoot you, so for goodness sake, shoot him now.
Were they all Poom people in the area where you were?
Yes, they were mainly Poom or Senate Fi. That's the anarcho-syndicalists. CNT, Central Nacional Trabajadores, FAI, Federation Anarquista Iberica. So that it's really the anarcho-syndicalist trade union. And they were a million of them. They were the most numerical preponderance. They were the strongest numerically.
How did the Poom and the anarchists get on with each other?
Quite well. Because, you see, they had in common the defence of the gains of the revolution and the resistance to the communist-inspired fellow travellers who were raiding telephone buildings, trying to get transport back into the hands of people they thought were good. The Popular Front view that, it's better to let the shopkeepers have what they had and not seek to keep what was taken during the original revolution. Just go the other way, restore it to the national owners. Well, the anarchists didn't like this at all. And I can understand this now better than I understood it at the time, because they had nothing really. They were very underprivileged and poor. And to give back something when they had nothing at all must have been quite a big thing to ask. Certainly, I would say it would get no response in British trade unions if the same thing was asked in the same situation. I'm sure the blokes would say, "No fear, we've got it now, and we're not going to risk losing it."
Was there any difference in discipline between the anarchists and the poem?
No, the same general laissez-faire, lack of discipline, and one might even say hostility, suspicion, and perhaps sometimes resentment towards it. Which is, as we've said before, perhaps the difference between militiamen and the soldier.
Did you get paid?
Yes, we did. We got paid, I think it was 10 pesetas a day. And you didn't get it each day, but we got it when we went on leave to Barcelona. And then we, we could spend it on meals and wine and general minor luxuries sort of thing.
You mentioned earlier on about how long you'd been in the ILP throughout the Second World War.
Yes, that's right. I stayed in all the time until 1945.
When did you actually join the ILP, though?
Oh, it must have been 37, not long after the Spanish thing. Not long after.
So you...
I was in the Guild of Youth, then the Young Communist League... then I joined the ILP after the Spanish thing, really. Although I was with the ILP contingent and the volunteer force in Spain, I thought their political position in Spain was quite right, and I stayed with them. I thought they were wrong over the Chamberlain thing, and Fenner Brockway wasn't all that happy either. Maxton was, and McGovern... certainly was. I mean, he even said to Chamberlain, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant." I thought that was going a bit much, you know. But that's the way they saw it, and John justifies it on the grounds that he had done a good service by keeping Britain out of war at a time when they were all prepared for it. There we are.
So, was it your experience in Spain that made you join the ILP?
No, not really. I've always been in that left position, but the Labour Party at the time, you see, they had this general non-intervention thing. They didn't have a particularly... officially, they didn't support it. The left-wingers did, but parliamentarily they couldn't. They had to go in with Leon Blum and all that sort of thing. So there was nothing really, apart from a general aspiration of socialism, to commend the Labour Party. The ILP had really more going for it. I mean, historically, it had better roots than the Labour Party in working class traditions. I mean, the Labour Party sprang from a lot of the ILP. It was before the Labour Party. And Keir Hardie and these sort of heroes were higher in our sort of stock reckonings than Labour Party people. So I was particularly pleased, I think, with the fact that they told the truth about Spain at a time when other people weren't telling the truth. So I was quite happy to join them and then stay with them. The fact that I thought that they were taking a wrong attitude on the war was, if you like, a quibble compared with the Labour Party, because a lot of the Labour Party, the George Lansbury's, the Arthur Greenwoods, felt the same way about it. It was only the fact that you got people like Attlee, who had some experience of the First World War, who felt that it's better to contain it and make sure that the mistakes that were made in the First World War weren't repeated. And I think it's still not recognised how fortunate it was for us in the Second World War to have people like Montgomery, Attlee, even Churchill, who had experience of the First World War and the senseless waste of life, who said, right, we won't make those mistakes. But and I believe that was quite important. Yes?
When you got back from Spain, had you decided then not to rejoin the Young Communist League?
Oh, I was expelled from the Young Communist League. They expelled me. John Gollan went to Bristol while I was still in Spain, in my absence, and ordered them to expel me.
For what reason?
Because I had written the truth, and it was published in the News Chronicle, the ILP paper, and Bristol Labour Weekly. And he said that I'd come under the wrong influence and all this Franco gold business. And my poor mother, she must have gone through it, because the young communists then, who previously had been my friends, are now completely turned against me. And they walk with placards up and down their road saying, you know, Cotman received gold from Franco, and my mother couldn't make out what it was all about at all. Seems ridiculous now, isn't it? Because we weren't that important.
So you sent articles back to Britain, did you?
Yes, oh yes.
To the News Chronicle?
Yes, I sent one to the Daily Worker as well, knowing that they wouldn't publish it, of course. Yes, the News Chronicle, the Socialist Leader, and the Bristol Labour Weekly. And they published what we consider to be the truth about Spain, the May Day things, the fact that the Poon didn't rise against the Spaniards and stab them in the back and shoot policemen and undermine law and order and welcoming Franco in. That's the way they presented it, you see. And
so who published what you wrote?
Well, the Chronicle, the Socialist Leader, and the Bristol Labour Weekly. And I think there was a letter in the New Statesman, too.
And was it just your work or other people's as well?
No, I did this particular one, on my own, because that's the way I felt. But I did sign some joint statements with other members of the contingent, the RP volunteer force, to say that these were the facts. And Bob Edwards got us to do that because he felt that historically we should be seen to respond to the situation at the time so that it wouldn't be possible to say anything else. Although Frankfurt, for example, still advocates the communist position. Frankfurt, he lives down in the street in Somerset now somewhere, he still believes that the communists were right and that oh, well, little things like saying we've got gold that are not really important. And, you know, but he believes that by advocating the revolution, we undermine the justice of the Spanish cause.
Did you just decide off your own bat to write this article?
Oh, yes. Nobody prompted me to. I knew it would lead to trouble, naturally, and I sent one to the Daily Worker, two, so that they could see what they were getting. And I was fairly sure there would be some repercussions. But funnily enough, I didn't think that they would send John Golan down to do the job as a one-off specific thing. I thought that they'd just let it take its time.
To expel you?
Yes. But they didn't. He went there deliberately to do it.
To Bristol?
Yes. And
did you get a reply from the Daily Worker?
No reply from the Daily Worker. Funnily enough, I didn't cover that particularly well, the Daily Worker, but they probably said something about it.
What do you mean you didn't cover it very well?
I didn't go to read the Daily Worker to see whether they had said anything about me. That's what I mean. I covered the Socialist Leader and the Bristol Labour Weekly because people sent me copies to say, oh, did you see this, you know? And I said, yeah, I knew I sent it. Good, I'm glad they published it. But not the Daily Worker, because I don't know any Daily Worker readers, I suppose.